At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Retrospects, really good model to use. We do them after projects, we do them internally, we do them with clients. What worked well on this project, it didn't. Let's have a little session, 20 minutes. We have some honest conversations that you don't normally do. And why would you wait for it to go wrong to have those conversations? Why don't you have them earlier?
So welcome back to episode 2 of Tricky to Title podcast. Today I'm joined by Tim Brind. And as we mentioned in the first episode that you've seen with Kelly, this podcast is all about talking to interesting people about interesting things, stuff that people are passionate about, but without any kind of commercial aspect to it. So no one's selling a service or a product. Within the podcast itself. Obviously, if you're interested to know more about my guests, they are all on LinkedIn. You can find them all there, and I'll confirm that at the end. Today, as I say, joined by Tim. He leads consulting teams that specialise in human-centred design. And between us today, we're going to be exploring the topic of showing up, which I'm very excited to talk about more. Before we get started, though, as always, there is an activity for us to do, Tim. So we have some empty mugs and we have some pens, and what I'll be asking Tim to do today is to draw me a lovely design on the mug that will sit behind me when I start to do the intros for these podcasts, and I'll have a lovely collection of mugs and grow over time. Tim is lucky enough to get my designed mug, which I'm sure is going to be terrible.
Love it.
Frankly, given my artistic ability. We also have Dave the Donkey, who is the podcast mascot. So Dave has been with me for a very long time. I've always loved donkeys, and my wife bought me that about 14 years ago now. So yeah, Dave comes everywhere with me. Sometimes he is my only friend. Moving on from that depressing thought. So Tim, perhaps you can do a little bit of an introduction about yourself to us, and then we can start on the topic.
Yeah, sure. So, wow, where do we start? Creative background in web design. That was during the .com bubble. Before that, degree in music technology.
Wow.
Yeah.
Didn't know that. What did you play?
So I played drums. I played piano.
How exciting.
Not at the same time.
Can you do us a little recording for like a little after show of the podcast?
We could do that. I could do your jingles.
Done. Very exciting.
So that meant I went freelance for a while after uni. Got a contract for a UK engineering firm who took me on full time. That got me into the world of, I guess we called it multimedia, right, back then. Mm-hmm. Got involved in lots of special projects, stuff nobody else could do. It was all kind of, you know, graphics or web stuff. But they were heavily specialised in engineering, aerospace defence, so I kind of worked on all kinds of things. Tanks, helicopters.
Wow.
Trained to be a technical author, technical illustrating, worked on the Apache helicopter, VH-71 presidential Obama's helicopter.
Wow.
Quite a lot of technical kind of engineering stuff, but at the same time I was running this kind of multimedia side of it. Mm-hmm. Built that up into a team into a department into a business unit, and I run that for about 5 years.
What happened? how have you ended up talking to me, Tim? What's gone wrong?
So I think about COVID time, there was a restructure. We shut the office down in Bath, lovely Bath where I live. That meant I moved sideways into consulting. So helped set up a team that was run by a guy called Danny Seals. Shout out to Danny. And I now lead that team. And that's a team of consultants. Headed that up for a couple of years. So I'm now head of performance architecture, which is very similar, but it's also all around human-centered design, strategy, and transformation. So it kind of takes us up to where we are now, where we met, actually.
Yes, yeah, we met during you did a project for us, and somehow you managed to put up with me, which was very kind of you, and so successful that we won an award for it.
We did.
Which is very much on my CV. It's the only thing of note on my CV, but it is there. So showing up, Tim, and don't forget to design, because I want that mark, and it's going to look beautiful.
So talk to me, are there rules of design?
The only thing I would say, knowing you as I do, Tim, is try not to make it too rude.
Wow.
Just because it's going to be in the video.
So really rude's out.
Really rude's out. Moderately rude is fine. I think that's kind of where we are. But yeah, other than that, draw what you want. I'm going to probably end up just drawing the same thing each podcast and hoping that it's slightly better each time. I'm not sure it's going to be, but we'll see.
Okay.
So showing up, what do you mean by showing up? What's the background to this being the topic that you wanted to talk about?
It doesn't really mean much, does it? It needs a bit of explanation.
It does, yeah.
It's about how we turn up to work.
Okay.
So expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Being prepared, being present. I think that's quite a good one, being present.
So is it the same thing as being present, or do you see it slightly differently?
I think it's all of those wrapped up into one bundle of goodness.
Yeah.
So I guess I was thinking about when you asked me to come on the podcast,
mm-hmm.
what we could talk about, and part of this was just wanting to have a moan.
it's often the best way. Yeah. And I'm very good at having a moan.
And I think that's where the idea came from. So we've all been in meetings, right, where there's been no point, there's been no output, there's been no agenda.
Yeah.
You know it could have been done offline. So showing up is kind of being prepared for that, or not putting other people in that situation.
Right.
And I think that's a key one, holding them to account when they do.
Okay.
So the flip side of showing up mm-hmm. is really good. It's when you show up in the right way, you kind of talk about high-performing teams, you've got improved ways of working. Right, everyone's in sync.
Yeah.
So there's a difference. There's a good and a bad side to it. And I think I've been fortunate enough to build those types of teams. So we codified our ways of working. We had that down. We had practices and rituals. So we knew what that meant, and we knew how to fix it. And that became the norm. And that was a really good kind of environment to be in.
So you use some language there. You codify and you use the word rituals. What do you mean by some of that?
Don't just wing it.
Okay.
If something
that's
works. Problem.
That's my life. That's the past 43 years gone out the window. Thanks, so, Tim.
I get asked for my processes, my procedures, like all the time.
Yeah.
And I ask other teams for it. And they don't have them. But you ask somebody else, oh yeah, we've got that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not talking big fancy stuff, a mirror board, but get it down.
Yeah.
Work out what works, chuck out away what doesn't.
Yeah.
Before you know it, you've got a ritual that everyone turns up on a Monday at 9:30 with something good, bad or ugly to share. Like, it's just different ways of working.
Yeah. Yeah, so a sort of mini culture,
exactly,
I suppose.
Exactly that.
Yeah. Okay. And that documentation, that getting stuff down creates that synergy between everybody, that agreement that this is how we're going to be and this is the way we're going to work because we've worked through that together as a group.
Yeah, and I think showing up is about having pride in the work, about having integrity. I think it's about giving shit as well.
That's the end. Yes, that is true. I get that. I just, how do you deal then with the days when you don't? Because everybody does, right? Everybody has days where they just, like, cannot bring themselves into that moment, be that the work that they're working on that particular point in time, be that the something that's happening in their personal life. How do you manage that combination of not, you know, one can be super present and excellent showing up every day?
Again, bring it back to expectations. I think imagine you're in a team where everyone knows their role.
Mm-hmm.
Play to each other's strengths. If you need some input on something, you know to go to Bob. Bob's great at doing that. Yeah. If you're looking for a different skill, you might go to Sue because you know she's great at that. And again, you've embedded that, so you know that's your go-to. So that's your inner circle.
Yeah.
Imagine the team the opposite. Bob's in the wrong role. He doesn't know what he's doing. But Sue couldn't really care, and Dave's taken 3-hour lunch break. It's a completely different vibe.
Yeah.
So how'd you deal with it? I think if you spent a bit of time with Bob working out what's wrong with him, you'd be able to fix it. If you understood why Sue struggles with research analysis and supported her, you'd push through it.
Yeah.
Dave's probably too late for Dave. It's not Dave the donkey.
No, he's hardworking. He always shows up.
So, and like I've been in that situation, so sometimes I mean, Bob leaves the team. Like, you've supported him, coached him, you've worked out he's better off working somewhere else, and that's great. So that's part of building up people. But yeah, probably too soon to start talking about P45s.
Yeah, maybe. So your point, though, I think is a really important one. I think then there's a couple of things I'd love to explore. The first is like doing this at scale. So if you've got a team, three or four people, I think that's, you know, you can come to that commitment. Doing it at scale, or conversely, as I've had experience recently, a completely remote team. You know, how do you manage some of that? But then also, I think, to your point as well, right, you get a lot of managers who are afraid of losing good people, sometimes just afraid of losing people, right? So that view of Bob leaves the team and that's a good thing, you know, again, that can be difficult to get team managers, line managers to accept. So how do you go about some of that?
We're touching on lots of things. It comes down to leadership style as well. Mm-hmm. Being servant-hearted, that's kind of where I would prefer to sit. So I'm going to coach Bob through that and get him through it.
So what do you mean by servant-hearted?
So there's different leadership styles, right? Yeah. Giving rather than taking. More authoritative. I think I sit more on that kind of left-hand side, but more servant-hearted. Going to coach people through pieces. I think that's important. I think you get more respect for it. Bob's never going to be happy in your team. So why are you keeping him there?
Yeah.
Is it for you? Is it for the business? Is it to make your life easier?
Okay. That's good. So how? What about the at-scale piece then? Mm. How do you, you know, you speak about individual line managers doing this, and I guess some of the challenge with that is each individual line manager creating a micro culture within their team, right? And not having that consistency of what good looks like across the whole organisation. So how do you manage that sort of stuff at scale?
That's a good question.
Because in my head, I'm thinking, you know, from a learning development point of view, if I think about typical leadership management programs, they'll focus on core soft skills. And we sort of, myself and Kelly touched on this a little bit last week around the role of talent marketplaces and the fact that we don't often train managers how to use the technology well to get good outcomes. But usually we're talking about, you know, the basics of coaching, the basics of having difficult conversations, the basics of et cetera, et cetera, with the hope that you create some consistency about how line managers manage that. How do you then, when you're then talking about kind of documenting your processes and procedures, getting engagement, getting agreement on ways of working, how do you help other line managers see what good looks like when it comes to that sort of thing? Or do you need to? I don't know. You know, even basic things, you say, well, we all turn up at X time on a Monday and we do this thing together and we do that. Like, does it matter if every team does that slightly differently? I don't know.
So I think it's more intrinsic and it's more on the individual level. So I think it's more about you being accountable for what you do, and that's how you choose to show up at work.
Right.
So I think having a point of view is really important.
Mm-hmm.
That's why people might come to you in your profession, right? You've got a view on X, you know how to solve Y. So I think that's good. But with that, it means not assuming it's somebody else's job.
Okay.
So let's say I turn up and we have a conversation and you don't want to do it because you think, oh, Sue can do that.
Yeah.
That's kind of, you're not showing up in the right way. In that example.
Yeah.
So, and I think listening is one of the easiest ways into that and probably one of the hardest things to do. You're not going to agree with everybody. You mean?
Yeah.
Right. Imagine the weirdo you meet on the bus that you don't want to talk to, but he wants to talk to you.
Yes. On the tube.
Exactly. You want to get out, you want to inquire, but you can't. So, like, no amount of showing up is going to fix that situation.
Yeah.
So, it's not always going to apply.
Yeah.
you do have to care about the situation going into. That's the intrinsic piece. You do have to want to fix it, show up in the right way.
Yeah.
So again, I think it comes back to the individual. So probably not answering your questions about leadership and teams, mm-hmm. but when you do get it right as a leader, mm-hmm. the effect is it cascades out to the team and you codify those ways of working and yeah. do establish those rituals.
So that kind of, I guess, doing what you say others should do, but doing it at a senior level and bringing it down through the management levels and making sure that it's demonstrated at a senior level. Because I do find that in my working life, I haven't always seen that. Right? Right. You're often like, you know, this is how we want leaders to be. This is, you know, we want you to be, you know, we want humility. We want you to, you know, open up and share your experiences and talk about where things have gone wrong. You know, all of those good things that a leader should do. But there seems to be a point sometimes in organizations that level that you get to and then that stops applying for some reason. And mistakes are, well, no, we never make mistakes, right? Other people make mistakes and we fix them now we're at that level. So, yeah, I think that principle of if you want people in your org to show up, you kind of need to do it too, I think is a really key
one. Is it the Peter principle? I'm trying to think which one it is, but the higher you go up, it's one of the graphs that we've all seen. The higher you go up, you become a leader, but you're not necessarily a leader because of your competence. You were there because of the hierarchy and you've scaled up.
Yeah.
So sometimes we see it as the graph. The graph illustrates that the higher you get, the less competent as a leader you become.
Yeah.
Even though that's your status. So why are you leading? Are you leading for the status? Or are you leading because you can show up?
Yes. Yeah, and that is really interesting. And I wonder how often we talk to leaders about that concept within their own development and within their own coaching. Mm. Interesting one to explore. So talk to me then, if you can, about some of your experiences, right? So, you know, I know you mentioned that this kind of stemmed from having a moan. So when have you, you've given a couple, but when have you seen it go really well? And what has that resulted in? And is that within just your team, or is that when you work with clients as a consultant? You know, what kind of things have you seen gone well, and how does that affect the output of what you're creating?
Yeah, so it's both. You get it down in your internal team, you then scale it to clients.
Yeah.
It's definitely about those rituals. You need a team to build trust.
Yeah.
But I won't talk about psychological safety, and it's just another way of telling people what they already know.
Yeah.
But once you've got that down, just talk. Just talk to your team.
Yeah. Find out what's going on, what's driving them, what their problems are.
But let's say Dave's working on a new design flow for a workshop. He now knows he can give Bob a call, ask him to break it.
Yeah.
Like we do that all the time. I think you and I started to do that. It's just running little sparring sessions. You got an idea, you want somebody to break it, pressure test it, challenge it. But everyone shows up in the right way.
Yeah.
And if they don't, what role do you want me to do today?
Yeah.
Do you want me to be a critique? Do you want me to challenge? Do you want me to coach? Just having that conversation is quite key, quite a good way into it. And if you're starting out, that's probably a good approach.
And I think this is a really interesting concept as well, the bit that you're talking about, getting people to break your stuff, right? By the way, how's your mug going? We'll have a look in a minute. I'll check in a second. I don't think much progress has happened, Tim.
Not my side.
No, I'm very disappointed. But unsurprised. But I think the concept of, like, as you say, I create this thing and I want someone to break it or tell me it doesn't work or how it could be better. That's quite an alien concept for a lot of people. You know, they're very proud of what they do, and asking someone to then come along and tell them all of the reasons that it's not very good or doesn't do what it needs to do or doesn't work over here, that's quite an intimidating concept, I think.
That's probably why people don't like me. So I guess my team are paid to fix problems, but we got to fix the right problem.
Mm.
So what I mean by that is the root cause stuff. We'll go and do some research. We'll understand the problem enough to be able to solve it. You've got to know you're solving the right challenge.
Yeah.
So if somebody says to you, that's wrong, that doesn't work, and you might be precious about that because that's your baby, and that's okay. But also, it hasn't worked until now, so what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
So you've got to have those conversations. You've got to try and make stuff, break it, and it's a good way of getting into, say, UX or product design. you've got, if you don't break it, put it out in your product and it's too early, it will fall over.
Yeah. So if you don't break it, someone else is going to. So yeah. You might as well get the positive, I guess, feedback about it being broken.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah. When you kind of get those rituals down, that works really well.
Yeah.
I think feedback's a good one.
Yeah.
If you can't challenge somebody in the right way, if you can't feedback or receive feedback, give off, take feedback. That's a problem. So getting a feedback model down is really crucial. Retrospects, really good model to use. We do them after projects. We do them internally. We do them with clients. Like, what worked well on this project? What didn't? Let's have a little session, 20 minutes. You have some honest conversations that you don't normally do. And why would you wait for it to go wrong to have those conversations? Why don't you have them earlier?
So we've done a lot of retrospectives in our team, and they are valuable, but they often happen, like, you know, a project may have lasted 4 months and we do a retrospective a couple of weeks after it's finished. We don't find we get the problems on the project in the last few weeks, right? They're normally sort of halfway through when you realise that perhaps the initial kind of diagnostic or root cause analysis wasn't as thorough as it needed to be, or something unknown has cropped up and we need to deal with that in the moment and we need to pivot. Usually that's when the problems surface. Yeah. And then you don't talk about them for 3 months until the retrospective, right? Which I've always found quite challenging, because you know, people sitting there going, oh, what went well?
Yeah.
And I can list that off, because that's always easy, right? Because that's being nice to people. And then people are like, oh, what could we have done better? And I'm like, you know, I actually can't remember, because it was so long ago. I know some stuff didn't work.
Yeah.
But what it was and the detail of it, that's gone, because I've had to deal with X number of other problems and other things since then. So how do you build that in, I guess, that concept of dealing with that in the moment rather than leaving that to... Because I think a lot of people will do a retrospective at the end of the project, right? And so they almost save it up because they're like, well, we'll deal with that in the retrospective.
Yeah.
And then it never really gets dealt with because it's so far away.
Yeah, no, you're right. People do leave it too late. You've got to do it the next week. Yeah. But what where it falls over a lot, people don't actually take the outputs from a retro. Doing a retro is great, but what do you do with it?
Yeah.
So we use the retro outputs as inputs to modify strategy or process.
Yeah.
It's really good data, but you've got to do something with it.
Yeah.
It's a bit like a strategy. Anyone can write a strategy, a really high level piece, but what does it actually mean at the ground level? Retro is kind of like that.
Yes. Yeah, I've experienced many strategies, and then when you sort of say, well, what does that mean? They're like, oh, well, yeah, that's the roadmap of work. So that's different. And I've always struggled with that concept that somehow a strategy is often referred to as a plan on a page, right? And a lovely vision, but with nothing behind it on how you're going to get there. Mm. And then when you have that conversation, it tends to be, well, that's somebody else is figuring it out. And it's like, well, who? Oh, I don't know. But someone's figuring it out.
Yeah.
You never really deliver on it. But I think that's very true of the retrospective, to your point, right? Is you get a lot of data out of the back of it, but who is ultimately responsible then for working that into the next project and making sure that we don't repeat
exactly
the same mistake.
Exactly. So we use the retro as we create trade-offs. We use the retro to kind of, what's more important to you is the quality of time. It could be anything, right? But the point is you're identifying the trade-offs as a result of the learns from the retro.
Yeah.
You then use them to inform what you do next. Next time we'll put in a situation we value quality over time. Okay, well, let's spend 2 hours extra if it means we get the result and don't get into that situation. Like, you've made a really good decision that you can embed as a guiding principle or whatever next time.
Yeah. Cool. Mug check. So since now you've added some, normally I'd have done it earlier, but Tim's a bit slow. So I have, if you've seen the first episode, this will not surprise you, I've gone for 3 T's. This time, however, they are actually green, not gold. Tim's not looking at my hard work. Thank you, Tim.
3 T's.
3 T's for a tricky 2 title, obviously. I have some grass around the bottom. And last time I did Dave's face, this time I've tried to do the whole of Dave. It's a little bit more work.
He's a wonky donkey.
He is a wonky donkey, as I said to my last guest. I have a honky wonky tonky donkey at home, which is an inflatable donkey that my youngest jumps around on. But yes, he's a honky wonky donkey. What have you got, Tim?
So this...
And show the cameras so people can see, because obviously, you know, this will encourage them, if they're only listening, to come and watch it. filled with self-confidence there, I think you're going to like this.
It's a little bit special.
Excellent. Well, I like special dogs. I'm a special person. Yeah. I like special things.
So.
Oh, wow. What is...
It's a bit abstract.
It's, yeah. Donkey ears?
No. Oh. So, you've got the Star Trek symbol there.
Excellent. Yes.
We've got a pair of Spock ears.
Yes, good.
And we've got some weird blue Enterprise spaceship at the bottom.
Oh, is that one? Is a spaceship, is it?
It's not good, is it?
I wasn't quite sure what that was.
It's got a spoiler, like one of your cars.
It's got a spoiler, like one of your cars. The Spock ears are very good. And it's gone downhill when you did the starship, but I like the rest of it. It's very impressive. Okay, we'll keep going. I had a specific question on this that I've thought about, and we've spoken a bit about some of the tools, right, with retrospectives and how you manage that. And I'll come back to that topic in a moment, because there are probably some others that we can explore and help people think about what they can do. But from a very personal perspective, right, for me, I think I probably need to be passionate about what I'm delivering. To show up, I need to feel like I'm adding value, I'm delivering something worthwhile, you know, it's something that I really want to do. I'm not, and I never have been, someone that can turn up for work, get paid and go home. I need to feel like I want to do the thing that I'm doing. And that's how I ended up in L&D and why I've stayed in L&D. How do you deal with that when you fall out of that? Because I have, on occasion in my career, fallen out of that moment. I've been moved to a role, or you know, I've ended up outside of doing something that I love. And I've found that it's made quite an impact on my own mental health in that space as well, right? Because you spend 8-9 hours, depending on the job, maybe more, a day in that space thinking about that same stuff. Yeah. If you don't enjoy what it is, and you're literally just showing up to get paid, that's quite hard from a mental health perspective. And what do you do to adjust to that? Do you either accept it? Is there things that you can do in yourself to find the things that are enjoyable in work? Or is it just a case of going, do you know what? I need to go and do something else.
Yeah.
Because, and being brave.
Yeah, no, it's that, because you're invested, or you want to be invested in projects you like. You are invested, you want to see it through. When you're not, you're kind of demotivated. Mm. I get it.
Getting attacked?
It's kind of, it comes back to caring and not caring.
Mm.
And if you don't care, do you still bother? Yes, you do. And there's what I mean by that. It's kind of...
It's an integrity thing.
There is integrity, but it's also battles that are worth fighting.
Mm.
And you've got to pick the right ones. So think of it another way. Think about the difference between a great project and a good project.
Yeah.
So if I think of a great project, I think it was... I'm quite fortunate to deliver some transformation projects, and that's what gives me a buzz.
Mm.
Seeing that change. And... one of the projects I did recently was a big transformation for a large consultancy, and it was great. I describe it as one of the best and worst projects in my career, because it was really hard. So it was good and it was bad, but we got where we needed to be. It's a great project.
Yeah.
Versus a good project where it was a very similar project, different client, different sector, still wanted a kind of technology-based project, product. But they didn't show up in the right way. The client found it hard to co-design. They found it hard to commit. So even though on paper the project was amazing, ways of working just weren't as good as they could have been. Yeah. Everyone wasn't quite as engaged.
Yeah. We've got a van somewhere reversing, by the way, so apologies if you can hear the beeping.
Beautiful in the sun, right?
It is beautiful in the sun. It's exactly why we're doing it outside. Just on that, so if I think about projects, to your point, the things that have gone really well, And when it's been harder. And I think about the things that have gone really well. And I think it is true that if I think back to it, the ones that have gone well, it's because the people are passionate about what they're doing and why.
Mm.
When it's not gone well, it's because people are, they're not like, they don't care, but they're just a bit more oblivion. Like they're just like, well, you know, great. That's, you know, someone's told me to do this thing. And I'm going to do a good job of the thing because someone's told me to do the thing. They've not volunteered and they've not got that kind of buy-in to really make that difference. And it is the passion I've found that really makes
yeah.
projects really great and actually changes the output. And even a hard project with people that are passionate, even if they don't agree with you and they're passionate, it's easier. The argument is easier because at least they care, and you can get a feeling from they're not trying to be difficult because I know they care. They have a different view from me. That's okay because they care. They don't just want to roll this thing out the door. Wherein you're on the project where people are, like I said, a bit more ambivalent, they're a bit more like, yeah. Either you won't have the discussion, you won't get a good outcome, right? Because maybe you were wrong, but you won't have ever had the conversation to work that out. Or you will, but you'll be jaded because you're sitting there thinking, well, they don't actually care. They're just arguing because they want to argue, right? And they're being difficult for being difficult rather than because, you know, it's going to make things better. So if I look back and think about it, I 100% agree with that. It is the passion of the individuals to make the difference.
It's a bit like watching a film on Netflix. If it's crap, you get my turning it off because you haven't invested any time in it.
No.
Whereas if you get three quarters of the way through and then you think it's crap, you're like, no, I'm going to stick with it. I'm in. I'm going to do it.
I've done this, yeah. Yeah, I've made my way through it.
But you do have to care. And if showing up's not going to work in every situation, right? It's, to your point, it's got to be the things you're passionate about because that's how you show up best.
Yeah.
And that's how you know you're doing your best because you've got that point of view. You've got that investment. You know what good looks like. So you bring the best version of yourself to that situation.
Yeah. Okay. Coming to a close, tools, tips. We've spoken about retrospectives. And there are other things. I know that you've kind of spoken scorecards is one of the things that we've spoken about. Like what are the other things that can help people either help their team show up and kind of get that microcosm of culture, or themselves be more present and show up?
We've covered a couple already, haven't we? I think the first one, can you talk honestly with your teams or with clients?
Yep.
Do you just say the things they want to hear? Or do you challenge to kind of, can you have that feedback model in place to know and fall back on it? And that's your safety net.
Yeah.
So do that. Talk honestly. Just practice it. Massively. I think the other thing is, the scorecards. And we did that piece, right? We kind of looked at doing these kind of EVP scorecards. Really good way of driving that level of accountability.
Yeah.
So look at your EVP, your employee value prop. How's it embedded? How do you see that brought to life? Get people to kind of rate it. Get those little touch points, those little pulse checks, and get some data on what that really looks like. Start driving and scoring that level of accountability with the scorecard. You can do it at ground level. You can do it through leadership, which is what I think where we looked at a culture piece on it.
Yeah.
So there's lots of ways into it.
Yeah. By the way, if you can hear in the background noise, it does sound like Tim is having his beer delivered. I suspect Tim is having his beer delivered in huge barrels. I don't know what this says about you, Tim. But
I'm actually making my own beer in the garage.
Why am I not surprised? Of course you are. We're in Bath. Is it in a bath in the garage?
Not yet. I may lay down in one later.
Excellent. There we go. Covered in beer.
Why not? But you say we're in Bath.
Indeed. Yeah, very Bath. Okay. Perfect. All right. So we have our mugs. Tim, you'll get this one. I will take yours home.
Love it.
I'm not going to tell anyone why the Star Trek reference is relevant, but if anybody wants to know, then you can contact me on LinkedIn. massive thank you, Tim, for your conversation, sharing your journey, insights, having a whinge. Thank you, everybody, to listening and or watching. If something sparked your curiosity, given you an idea, made you think how you can learn, I'd love to hear about it. You can find Tim and I on LinkedIn, as I've said, or you can email me at trickytotitle@gmail.com. And I'll also give you the insight then into A, spandex, and B, Star Trek. as mentioned in the last podcast, I've asked ChatGPT to give me a ongoing kind of message that I can use at the end. So it is slightly cheesy, but I'm going to stick with it. So you know it, I'm Richard Pedley. Stay curious. Stay messy, and don't worry about the title.